the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz from the Science of Psychotherapy, and I'm here with my best mate, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Look, I'm best, and I'm managing editor of the magazine, which is coming out every month. We hope people jump in and see that and subscribe for those that are interested, or just take it issue by issue.
Yes.
What a wonderful thing, and how wonderful to see you again, young Matt.
Yes, great. Well, thank you for that, young Matt. I like that one, yes. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Today, we are revisiting a couple of our experts, our resident experts here at the Science of Psychotherapy, Teddy Valise and Rita Princey-Hubbard. And we're going to talk about kids and education once again, because it's a terribly important topic. Right, Richard?
Yes, it is. And we've had some stuff from Teddy in the magazine. Maybe we could offer something at the, we'll do it at the end of the broadcast, because we better get on with it and get in and see what they have to say.
Absolutely. Let's go across to Teddy and Rita. Teddy Valise and Rita Princey-Hubbard, welcome back to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. How are you both?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Good.
And Teddy, and it's Richard. Richard's here as well, so it's a foursome today, which is fantastic.
Yes. Now, for those that don't know, Teddy, introduce yourself. You're one of our resident experts, so there will be a lot of people that do know you, but there will be some that don't. So tell us who you are, where you're coming from, and what you're all on about.
Yes, my name is Teddy Valise. I am a marriage and family therapist in California, San Jose, California. And I work pretty much with everybody, families, but I have a huge specialty on children, specifically what we're calling sensitive children, which we'll talk more about in the podcast.
Yeah, fantastic. And we've got some great articles that Teddy has had in the magazine, and so we will point people to that in the show notes. Rita, welcome back. How are you?
Good, thank you.
How are things down South Australia?
Actually, very contrary to what I've been hearing about Sydney and Brisbane, we've got a very cool day today, 21 and rain. So we have interesting weather here. We go from the 45s and 47s all the way back down to the 20s. So.
Well, you've got that big bike riding. I'm sure there's a proper name for bike riding things.
Tour Down Under.
Yes, that's it, the tour, yeah. But anyway, so they'll be very grateful, because very often we've had that thing, the Tour Down Under, 45 degrees. And anyway, so this is... So bit of rain. So Australia's weather are bonkers, but we're getting by. So okay, Matt, we have a lot to talk about today.
We do. We're back talking about education and children. And so, Rita, do you want to kick us off? And first of all, let us know about the upcoming conference that you have.
Yes, I'm happy to definitely tell you about the conference. It's our second Australasian conference. We were really fortunate last year to have our inaugural, and it was well attended, and we had great feedback. It was a wonderful blend of people who are obviously working with children, from educators to practitioners, but you know, really anyone attended that was really wanting to know about understanding children. So we're doing it again in Melbourne. The first 2 days of conference, the 30th and 31st of March. Then I'm very privileged to be hosting a parenting session on the Tuesday night on the 31st with Teddy and with David Collins. And then on Wednesday, we decided to have a whole day workshop. So educators or therapists or parents want to come along again, just to really be able to talk to Teddy, to David and myself, and to explore perhaps certain cases or situations that they're finding challenging, all following a neuroscience approach, which I think is always great, because it helps understand what's happening to us. And to take your quote, Matthew, that science of us, it's so applicable, and I think it really helps us, and the children just benefit so greatly.
Fantastic. So, Teddy, tell us a little bit about what you'll be covering.
Well, so my workshop is going to be talking about the so-called sensitive kids. We've come up with a top, I think I'm trying to remember the exact name of the workshop. I think it's called the Ferrari Brain. Help me out, Rita, is something or non-compliance? Creativity or non-compliance?
It's sort of like, is it from creativity to non-compliance?
Non-compliance, that's right. Yeah, so in essence, what I'm trying to highlight in this workshop is that these kids are usually labeled with all sorts of challenges. emotional, behavioral, even learning disabilities, cognitive challenges, ADHD. And underneath that, what makes them so challenging, there are these qualities that are very related to creativity. But if they're not in the right environment, what shows up is the bad behavior, and we miss the talents. Okay. And so in a nutshell, that's what, and the Ferrari brain concept is like, if you imagine having a Ferrari, which I don't have, it's a car that doesn't perform in just any terrain. You have to have a very special, road for it to perform at its best. Mm. So that's what goes along. And then the intensity of that engine, that it's always, just very intense, very well oiled, but it requires a lot of maintenance as well.
Yeah, and this is why we wanted to have you guys on again, because for those who saw Rita on just a little while ago, because this to us is one of the most to Matt and I is one of the most important subjects is kids, is education, and in the same breath as that, the parents and education. There's a lot we do about adults and teaching them things, but this point of education, and one of my degrees is in education. So I was always fascinated listening to all the fabulous programs that everyone were doing, principally on an intuitive, just felt sense that this was good for kids and it was great. And what was lacking in their strength was this background knowledge, this more reliable science base that they could smack in the face of the people resisting them. But this point of compliance and creativity, it's such an interesting thing. They're almost antithesis of each other. The more you make someone comply, the less they're able to be creative. And just the last comment that I'd love to hear your comments on, Teddy, is the Ferrari brain, it's absolutely true and doing that. But when you think evolutionarily, we often talk about the fact that we've developed a Ferrari brain, but it's still built on a Model T Ford. So it's balancing those two is something that we're not good at. And a lot of our education systems, really, they're more based on the Model T Ford frameworks of our mental structuring rather than this expansive Ferrari type of possibility.
That's exactly right. And I tell you, it sometimes scares me to say those things because I worry that people are going to feel criticized. Because in a way, we're making comments about the traditional approach is not really serving everybody. And it's very, very scandalous. But going back to this concept of creativity, something that I, you know, I've been talking, you know, last podcast on my blogs and a little bit on the magazine article that you guys published in July and August. I've been talking about this kids being sensitive, but I've been able to dig out some research to actually give more texture to what that really means. And one of the most important things to highlight is the way that these kids learn is completely different than the way that, let's call the normal kids, these dandelion types, learn. It starts with the way that they take in information from the environment. There's something, and this has to do with the way their dopamine system works, which is dysregulated just broadly by early life stress, whether that happens in utero or shortly thereafter, for whatever reason. Sometimes there's intergenerational epigenetic transfer of trauma from many generations ago that has nothing to do with the quality of life of the actual parents of the kid. And in essence, what happens is that the thalamus, because of the effect of the dopamine, takes in more information than normal people. So it's almost like they get bombarded. It's called reduced latent inhibition. Most of us have this latent inhibition ability to filter information. So maybe we get every 10 bits of information. These kids get the entire thing. And this information is vivid, is intense. it stays longer in cognitive memory, in conscious awareness, and all this is happening while the parents have no idea that this is going on. So an example of this would be people that have sensory challenges, you know, mm-hmm. that the lights and sounds. But it goes deeper than that. So that's that. And this is happening 24/7 in this kid's lives. And we don't know that this is happening.
Yeah. So this is the thing, Rita, and particularly the parents' workshop, that these kids are unavoidably sensitive to information. Doesn't mean they're weak or unresilient. It just means they have the conscious awareness of these things happening. And I imagine these workshops with the parents is actually to increase their sensitivity to the sorts of inputs they're getting, rather than just their limit. I don't know what limits, what interferes with the parents' sensitivity to these types of children, do you think?
Well, I think it's because, and I think Teddy and I have discussed this, and I'm going to hand over to him because he really explains it well. But interesting, a couple of things. I think if our approach is always that we need to control the child, so to fit a certain traditional framework, then that can be problematic. Parents can feel embarrassed. They can believe that they're not doing their job properly. But Teddy explained to me that sometimes the parents themselves could be these sensitive children. And maybe they needed to comply to, in their time, I suppose. And so when they have their children acting this way, then that can trigger them. Is that correct, Teddy?
Yeah. So there's so many layers of this. So this is, as I mentioned, this is triggered by early life stress, but it is mediated by genes. So not every kid that experiences early life stress will end up hypersensitive like this kid's. We know that. And so what researchers are trying to find are starting to find out is that there are these risky genes that are usually responsible for self-regulation, and it is those genes that make things go in high gear, so to speak. So if there's a genetic impact, that means that the parents, either one or both, are sensitive as well. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of parents tell me, you know what, Teddy, yeah, I get it. I am sensitive. I remember feeling, a little bit more anxious or more depressed when I was a little kid. But I wasn't off the rails like my son. He needs to learn. He needs to understand. And so this is the challenge, that as time has gone by historically, the environment that we live in becomes more stressful. And that makes a difference. So an ORCID kid, a sensitive kid that's born today, they're in the environment that they're being born into is way more stressful than if they were born when we were born, for example.
Okay.
So this point, when parents make that judgment, they're not keeping that into account, and it's a big difference.
But I think there's two sides, just quickly, and I want to get Matt's thoughts too, because we're talking about the sensitivity, the difficulties of the sensitivity, and that's a natural thing for us to do. But of course, the other thing is this sensitivity increases their degree of engagement and the excitement and that they can have about something in a great way, and much more. They can learn much quicker. They can see more of the frame. It's this battle that goes on as well. But this ties in a lot, Matt, with what we were talking about with Dan Siegel the other day.
I was thinking along the same lines that when Teddy was talking about this reduced latent inhibition of the thalamus receiving all this information, is there an upside to that? Is there something, positive and creative with this state of being as well? I'm not sure. Teddy?
Yes. So what I did is that I've superimposed research on creativity on research on mental illness and all the challenges that we diagnose kids with. And you're completely right. If the kid is in an environment that is supportive, and this is the coaching that I do with parents, if the environment is supportive of this, I guess, nonlinear, hyperactive, multiple channel. It's almost like they process through multiple channels.
Yeah.
We're able to tolerate that. These kids see things that are just that other people don't see. I mean, it's really what I learned in one of the studies that I found is that there's something that's called the creative bias. And the definition of creative bias is how these kids learn.
Right.
So for normal kids, it requires quiet and focus. For these kids, they need defocused attention.
Hmm.
For normal kids, they need almost like a linear path of information. For them, their brain, that they need non-linear. They need a lot of information from different sources. Normal people need one information that goes from A to B to C. So the entire thing is really the opposite. For the sensitive kids, learning is connected to the basal ganglia, which is more involved in voluntary control, meaning movement. Let's do something. Let's figure out how can we apply this knowledge right here, right now. Whereas in more normal people, the learning is more involves the medial temporal lobe, which involves all this explicit memory systems, including the hippocampus.
Yeah.
And I can keep going on. You know, examples.
And I know this. I'll just quickly chuck it and then match your question. But I'm just, my mind goes to someone, I suppose, as an adult example. We don't know, but just as an example, maybe a Robin Williams who had this amazing stuff that was possible because of his sensitivity. But then, of course, yes, there were some great difficulties that emerged in his coping mechanisms as well.
So I'm getting into the habit. I've become so interested in these people that are, you know, that we consider successful and revolutionary. And so little by little, I keep looking into their lives. And it just doesn't fail. I was just looking at watching an interview with Bruce Springsteen. And he says that when I was a little kid, I was the epitome of a neurotic, sensitive kid. So this language is always there. And they're able to blossom. And again, this is the orchid thing. They blossom into this amazing ability to change the world, but only if they're lucky enough to find the support, usually of an adult. It doesn't have to be a parent, but they need somebody that can help them channel that. Because everybody else is going to look at them. And this is, again, this is my bias, and maybe I've talked about this, but I think it's so much challenging for a boy to be labeled sensitive than it is for a girl.
Yeah, so there's cultural, social.
There is this masculinity thing that we can do a separate segment on that. Because they don't subscribe to what is perceived as masculine. This kids, even as adolescents, they do not like, it starts when they start to play soccer and sports, team sports, when they're 6, 7 years old. They don't like the bantering,
right.
They like the sport. They're good at the sport, but they don't like the kind of like, oh, you lost, you stupid. They hate that. And so they end up quitting because of the culture. And then as adolescents, they don't like this thing of boys talking about girls. And so they start to become isolated because of that, because they're not part of the norm. But we need people like that.
I was just going to say, you know, culturally, socially, culturally, these people are very important. As, you know, we talk about, you know, the different people that have changed cultures and been extremely creative. And so we can't afford to have them shut down. And Teddy, I was just going to ask you, when it comes to, you know, what sort of percentage are we talking about?
Yeah, this is 15 to 20%, and I'm just kind of quoting the research of Thomas Boyce, who's pretty much spent his entire career. He just retired researching this, so it is significant. But I think this is more significant, what I'm going to say, and that is that I believe, because of what Richard was talking about, that this the way that their brain works, these are people that actually they're the ones that shape the world, whether because they're extraordinary, like, you know, like an Elon Musk or a Thomas Edison or Bruce Springsteen, or because they are a manager, a leader, a politician. And then there are some that self-destruct and they end up being drug addicts. They end up in jail.
Right. This world isn't compliant, isn't conducive a lot. And it's really interesting the nature of Ernest Rossi and I, and sort of Ernest Rossi and me following and Milton Erickson before him. Sensitivity is actually one of our key points. And in my the advanced workshop, at least half of the workshop is all based around increasing people's sensitivity or giving them greater access and awareness of their sensitivity. And so it must be really, and meaning that it is totally socially acceptable for them to be less sensitive than they actually are. But these kids, of course, they're really having to struggle against this disparity, this discord, this dissonance between socially desired sensitivity and just what hits them. Interesting.
Yeah. So what needs to shift? If we can bring it back to the classroom, to education environments and systems, where should we be going?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that research studies that I think are very telling. One of them I shared on that the podcast that we did last year, so I'm just going to briefly mention it. But in essence, there's a social dominance hierarchy in every culture, whether it's a classroom or a corporation or society, and kids as young as kindergartners are able to develop that social hierarchy. So the sensitive kids end up at the bottom of that hierarchy. What happens is that not every classroom looks the same. There are some teachers that are more supportive of these kids that are more sensitive. And what the teacher does matters. If the teacher kind of stands back and kind of joins in the popular kids and almost use them as a way to control the dysregulated kids, then there is a big correlation between the kid's sensitivity and pretty much any measure of well-being, including right. academics and anxiety, depression. But if the teacher actually mediates that, then that relationship disappears. So the right. teacher, there's a lot, the kid doesn't change. We're not changing the behavior of the kid, but what the teacher does makes a big difference. Mm. Now there's another study that I think is even, because this first study was cross-sectional. The study that I'm going to talk about now is longitudinal, which, you know, it we can say that there's a cause and effect. So 6-year-olds were tested right before starting first grade. And the researchers found out who was the more physiologically dysregulated type. And those kids correlated with mental health challenges, internalizing problems, anxiety, depression. Then they tested them again when they were 13. And if these kids had a good relationship with their first grade teacher, their well-being was good.
Right.
But if they had a challenge with their first grade teacher at age 13, it right. showed.
So there's your key variable.
That is amazing.
These yeah. first grade teachers, we should be very careful how we choose them.
I had a great amazing. First grade teacher. And actually, it's as I look back in my life, and I've done this separately from this conversation, that has been one of the high points, that particular person. That's interesting, you know, because she allowed, there are other things I was thinking of in my education thesis. I just used established documentaries and films and things as data because, you know, it saved having to go through all the other bits and pieces. But I was just thinking of films like The Freedom Riders, Stand By Me. It was what the teachers did, and you could watch these children blossom. But then there were each characters, and I can just think of some of the characters that, yeah, you were super sensitive, And she enabled it to come out and become productive, gruel in the Freedom Riders. So there's places that people can just sort of go, just go back to some of these films and documentaries on great teaching, and you'll probably be able to see it now that you've given us some insight into what we're looking for. I'm going to go back and have a look at a couple of things.
Yeah, I'm going to mention something that I think it's really important, because I do believe that teachers, parents, caregivers, even therapists, there's a lot of therapists that you know, subscribe to this, like, you know, you have to be a better kid. You can't do that to your mom. What happens, though, is that, you know, teachers are part of this group of people that are part of that 15%, I believe. You know, the work that they're doing, their vocation. These kids have learned they want meaning. From a very early age, they want to save the planet. They want to volunteer at the pets that don't have homes. They get angry at their parents for wearing leather. These are young kids. They have that within themselves. And if these teachers, these little children that eventually became teachers, if they had that sensitivity and their parents did not support it, some people are able to shut down the emotions, and then they become cognitive.
Yeah.
Now, I believe, from my experience and from the research that I'm doing, it's easier for women to do this than it is for men. Boys self-destruct. Women can actually just crawl on the floor out of trauma. It's easier for them to do that. Their brain matures faster. So let's look at this teacher that somehow was able to survive not a great environment, and then they become very logic and cognitive, positive thinking. I can control the world if I think it in a certain way. And now they have to deal with a kid that's all emotional. It's almost like we're re-traumatizing them. They spend a lot of time almost like finding a way to cope. And this happens to parents as well. So in a way, and sometimes parents are upset. They actually tell me, this is not fair. I have to do for them what my parents weren't able to do for me. I mean, I get it. I understand. These are not bad people, but that's there. They eventually do it. They eventually do what's right for their children. But this brings up immense amount of emotions. And if people don't have the support to process this, I don't think it's that easy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, just to be fair, you know, that just to be fair. And, you know, like I mentioned to Rita, the last call that I had with her, is like, Rita, I worry, you know, I apologize many times with parents. I try. Hey, this is not your fault. This is something that's bigger than the two of us. Because people feel bad, people feel judged, people feel that they're not good enough. All of that, all of those feelings from when they were young, of not being supported, they come crashing back, and they get in the way of the task at hand, which is to help the kid. That's the reason why in this protocol that I outline in my article, the first step is to help the parent self-regulate. If they can't self-regulate, they can't help the kid.
Yeah, I've got actually something coming up this week, and with a child who's not learning, probably learning difficulties, but the way the system teaches, they're not learning that way, and it's really fabulous. I've been chatting with the parent for quite a while about this. Anyway, rang up the other day, and he said, we'd like to come in. And I'm going, great. And he said, I think maybe I should come in first. This is the father. And I'm just going, wow, you have just saved me weeks of convincing. So, but it is interesting that I'm curious with him and his sensitivity, which he suppressed because he was sensitive enough to realize that he needed to do the work. You've given me about 50 ideas. I will now have to go off and think about that, but really, really, really good. But Rita, getting in there, this it's the way the conference, you know, can have something like Teddy and they're talking about these sort of very sensitive children, but the way the conference balances out and each lecture seems to have some sort of supportive frame for others. It just feels much more like a dynamic type of system in the conference rather than just a series of disconnected elements. What was this in your thinking?
Absolutely, Richard. I think you've hit the nail on the head. Yes, I'm thinking of it more as a gathering of like-minded people, all with the same goal to understand and obviously to support children, but teachers, parents, you know, the whole system really. And, you know, it'd be great if you and Matt came along and you could also have a feel of that, yes. And, you know, all the comments at the end were that, you know, we made new friends, we really feel enthused, they're bringing more people this time. So it's a really supportive conference.
Well, Matt, we'd have to walk around together so they knew who we were.
That's right. All right, this has been absolutely brilliant. We're sort of coming to the close now. So, Teddy, are there any sort of last words you'd like to share with our listeners before we leave?
Yeah, you know, I kind of want to reiterate that this is new information that as a society, it's countercultural. It goes against you know, what I call command and control. Right. That, you know, I'm older and you have to obey me. And I know, you know, I know everything and you don't. So I'm responsible for you. So I make the choices for you. And so it requires a lot to be able to take this in. I'm very aware of it. But I think as we talked before, it is so important. You know, the best way that I describe this kids is that they exude the highest levels of humanity.
Right.
And beautiful. When I work with them, I feel hopeful. And that's why I'm so committed to this work, to this, you know, to looking at mental health from this perspective.
Yeah.
What a beautiful orientation to take with you. Not we've got a problem, we've got a fantastic thing. Yeah. Love it. Love it.
Beautiful. Rita, any last words?
Just thank you again for giving us the opportunity to highlight the conference. Obviously, as you can see, two great speakers with David last week and Teddy. And please, you know, I encourage your listeners and viewers to check out our website to see all of our amazing speakers. They all, as you say, bring a wonderful element of their interest, but also it all fits in together. So I hope that if people are interested, they check out the website. Or feel free to contact me. My contact details are on the website too. So thank you very much again.
Yeah. Fantastic. We'll have a serious look about coming along. It'd be great.
That'd be great.
Absolutely. Teddy, Rita, thank you so much for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast, and all the best with the conference.
All right.
Many thanks. Thanks.
Thank you much.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
It's always great to talk to Teddy, and Rita there is so supportive of all the work, and this conference sounds, you know, really terrific.
But absolutely.
This whole idea of sensitivity is so central to my work as well. So so he takes it to another level of understanding, which is wonderful.
Isn't it interesting, this you know, the key variable is these first grade teachers and their approach to these sensitive kids.
Well. So I think people really need to know a lot about this.
Absolutely.
I want to release his article just for everyone to get access. So people listening on the podcast. So I was thinking we could make his July 2019 article available. All you have to do is jump in and go through the academy, and you can download the PDF of that article.
Absolutely. Well, let's do that. I'll put a link in the show notes, and that'll be for Teddy's The Parent-Child Neuropsychotherapy Protocol article that he wrote for us last year.
And he highlights all the stuff about the orchid childs and what it's all about and why it's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. So, encourage everyone to read that one. It is it's very important. Well, Richard, it's been fun, as usual.
As usual. And that's another week, and goodbye from me.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.